company against Virginia Department of Taxation, Richard L. Weiser, Robert L. Mulmore, E. Company against Virginia, Robert W. Lawson, William Allen, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Toby J. Heitz, Solicitor General, Stephen A. Cobb, Deputy Attorney General, Matthew R. McGuire, Principal Deputy Solicitor General, Elizabeth Lynn L. Myers, Assistant Attorney General, Deputy Ann Lipinski, Dallin, Harold E. Johnson for the appellate.
Mr. Lawson?
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Lofton from McGuire Woods. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Robert Wilmore from Crowell and Mooring, a member of the Bar of the District of Columbia. He's been admitted pro hoc vitae, and he'll be arguing for the Corporate Executive Board.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilmore, welcome. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. And Chief Justice Clemens, if I could reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
I appreciate it. May it please the Court. Pursuant to the instructions of the General Assembly in Code Section 58.1421 and the Department's own regulations, the Department was required by law to use an alternative method of apportionment on the facts of this case. If CEB's apportionment is either inequitable or inapplicable, that is, unconstitutional, the Department must, if so requested by the taxpayer, use an alternative method that is neither inapplicable nor inequitable. This special relief provision exists because the General Assembly well understood that apportionment formulas, even tried and true formulas that usually work, can at times produce unfair and even unconstitutional apportionments. And if they do, the Department must correct that. Because the apportionment here results
May I ask you about the constitutional point? Has the U.S. Supreme Court, I found this point somewhat elusive in studying our cases, has the U.S. Supreme Court ever squarely held that double taxation means an unconstitutional apportionment? I mean, they've danced around it, hinted at it.
I don't think that they've squarely held that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think they've, as the Court has indicated, as Your Honor has indicated, they have talked about it. The decisions, I don't know if I would use the word dance around it, but they have different views, the different justices. But double taxation, and this is an area where we in the Department, I think, have a strong...
Some of the experience. Academic commentary uses harsher terms.
Yes.
I thought I was being nice, but okay.
And that is true. But where we in the Department have a very strong disagreement, I think, is that the Department takes the position that double taxation is irrelevant to the fair apportionment requirement. I think it's very clear that's not correct. Now, will double taxation in and of itself? I don't know. The Court has gone, there have been different decisions, Mormon, but then post-Mormon decisions that have emphasized double taxation.
Well, if the precedent is that unclear, why don't we go back to first principles and ask what congressional regulation was being violated here, because that's what the Commerce Clause says.
Well, the fair apportionment requirement, the dormant Commerce Clause, is what is being violated.
So isn't the point here that when the precedent is as ambiguous as this, and your best case is a 5-4 opinion with Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg in dissent, that it's probably not the best platform to try to extend the law?
Well, Your Honor, I would answer it two ways. And maybe the first way is we have two issues here. We have the inequitable apportionment issue, and we have the unconstitutional apportionment issue. And the Court does not need to reach the constitutional issue unless the Court determines that the apportionment here is not inequitable.
But by the statute's terms, it's not the Court that determines inequity.
The Court reviews the decision that was made by the Department.
So we don't grant deference to the Department?
No, Your Honor, I don't think. As far as whether it's inequitable, the test is set out in the regulation. The regulation is very specific. It's in our view, it's not an ambiguous regulation. It's very clear. It's a two-part test. The first test is their double taxation. There it is. The second test is, and I quote the regulation, the inequity is attributable to Virginia rather than to the fact that some other state has a unique method of allocation and apportionment. Given that double taxation is clear here, the only question is, Is this the result of some unique method, some fluke or unusual standard that another state has in its apportionment process? And it's clearly not. And the department doesn't even argue that it is. Because the other states that are taxing or using CB sales for their apportionment purposes are using some form of destination or market-based sourcing, which is used for tangible products in virtually all the states, and for intangible products, and I think the department itself concedes that, for many states, possibly even up to half the states. So here we have a situation where the regulation clearly provides that some alternative method of apportionment, that CEB is entitled to some alternative method of apportionment. And there's no discretion for the department at that point to say, no, despite the fact that you're entitled to an alternative apportionment under our regulation, we're still not going to give it to you. Now, there may be some discretion with regard to which alternative apportionment, and of course the department has never proposed another alternative method of apportionment, and the only other alternative method of apportionment before this court today is the method that CEB has proposed, the proposed method.
So, but since the department never reached that issue, and they seem to have some discretion, why, if you win on your secondary assignment of error, why isn't the answer to remand to say, look, department, you just categorically rejected this, but whether it's your method or some other version, you need to study this and think about it afresh, as opposed to us just saying, no, adopt the taxpayer's method?
Well, Your Honor, that's certainly one option the court could use. It could go down that road and could say, this apportionment is inequitable, or this apportionment is unconstitutional, or both. We're going to remand for the department to determine whether to use the proposed method that the CEB has proposed, or another method.
Let me see if I've got it straight. You indicated that the destination-based sourcing method is used in many states, possibly up to half.
For intangibles.
Okay. I thought you said that was for intangibles. What about for intangibles?
Well, I'm sorry. For tangible goods,
it's the majority.
It's I think virtually every state.
Yeah, but it's for intangibles, you said.
For intangibles, and the department itself in its brief on page 34 concedes that roughly half, I think a little less than half,
okay.
Use
so
some method.
So a little more than half, in other words, the majority, use the cost of performance.
Well, no. I think today it's less than 15, use what's called pure cost of performance. Some states don't have a corporate income tax.
Yeah.
And then some states that have a corporate income tax use a hybrid. And some hybrids are closer to cost of performance, some are closer to
More
market.
States use cost of performance in some fashion than destination sourced for intangibles. Is that a fair statement?
Other states? Yes,
yes. Yes. Okay. So if we're just looking at those two, the majority goes with cost of performance.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. I don't think the majority, at least pure cost of performance the way Virginia uses it,
I
think it's split roughly.
Okay. All right. Let me move on to the second half of my question. In terms of looking back in time, it typically was the cost of performance 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Yes,
that's correct. And that's when Virginia started to use it.
Yes, correct? I think in the 60s, correct.
Okay. So back in the 60s, Virginia started to use cost of performance, and most other states used it at that time. At that time, it was fair.
I believe that's correct.
The reason why you are arguing an inequity now is because other states, desiring to gain more revenue, have used a newer apportionment method, destination source, correct?
Well, the inequitable standard is really more formalistic in nature than that. It really only looks to two questions. And I think both questions are answered in the affirmative. And I don't think
50,
the department
60
even
years ago, Virginia's was fair and was not unconstitutional. You would not have been up here arguing it 50 or 60 years ago.
Because it was not the
and
type
the only
of
reason that it's changed is because other states have desired to gain revenue and have changed theirs And so you are here arguing that therefore Virginia must change its apportionment, even though Virginia's remains the one, the majority of those that use one of these two.
Well, I'm not sure Virginia is the majority. There are less than 15 states that use Virginia's method. And in the stipulations, we point out there are 36 states in the years of question where CEB paid tax, and only a little over a third actually use Virginia's method.
I think I've squeezed as much nectar as this orange will allow. So
okay.
Go ahead.
But I want to clarify, and it's important, because double taxation may not have existed 30, 40, 50 years ago, but it exists today. And it's this tax year that's at issue.
But
and this tax
can I interrupt you, but isn't the point, is it really Virginia's fault? I mean, isn't that sort of the gut point, which is we've done it this way forever. Other people can change their mind. That's fine. Maybe they need to have the suits filed in their jurisdictions.
Well, I don't look at it as a question of fault. I look at it as a question of what is causing the double taxation.
Okay, that's a fair thing. We've been doing it all this time. Other states have changed. Why wouldn't the proper response, even under the Dormant Commerce Clause, be go to the other states and throttle them back?
Because I think the regulation says otherwise. The regulation says, is it the result of Virginia's method of apportionment or some other state's unique method of apportionment? Not some other state's method, but some other state's unique method. And the destination-based sourcing is not unique. It's by far and away, it's not unique.
But you're reading a lot into the word unique. You basically, are saying, well, as soon as we cross the, 51% as soon as we cross midfield, we got to throttle back because we're being overtaken by all these other states using a destination source model.
Well, again, 421, the relief statute, is designed to deal with individual taxpayers, with individual cases for inequity. And here, there's just no dispute. This taxpayer, CEB, is having its sales used by 20 to 23 states in the years in question for its apportionment in those states. And it's having almost all of its sales used for its apportionments in Virginia. As a result, there's substantial double taxation, and it's paying tax, if you include all the income that's apportioned to it, on over 120% of its actual nationwide income.
One thing I wondered is whether this regulation, with the U.S. Supreme Court hinting repeatedly that double taxation violates Dormant Commerce Clause, that this regulation, which dates back to, I believe, 1985, was put into place as an escape hatch to avoid the danger of potentially unconstitutional double taxation. And as the states are rejiggering their tax codes to account for the growth in the service economy, this essentially escape hatch is put into place so that a taxpayer who is unfairly double taxed, possibly unconstitutionally double taxed, can avail himself of this mechanism for relief.
Yes, this type of provision has sometimes been called the safety valve or the relief statute, and that's exactly its purpose. Its purpose is to deal with the situation where there is substantial double taxation, or there's double taxation, and it gives the department the opportunity to go in, and the requirement, not just the opportunity, and provide the taxpayer with an alternative method of apportionment that fixes that double taxation. That's what the department refused to do here. Because they refused to do it, they violated the statute. They violated their own regulation. And now we're in the territory where if there is no alternative method of apportionment, the apportionment is unconstitutional.
You wanted to reserve some of your
time.
I mean, you may use your time any way you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Right.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Toby Heitens on behalf of the Department. The Circuit Court correctly held that Virginia's long-standing apportionment rules do not violate the Constitution as applied to CEB, and that the Department did not abuse its discretion in rejecting CEB's request to use a different method. If I can go to a question that Justice Kelsey asked about the standard of review, this is directly from this Court's decision in Lucky Stores at page 127. It says, an alternative method may be used only if, in the exercise of sound discretion, the tax commissioner concludes that the three-factor formula is, in fact, inapplicable or inequitable. So we think this court has already decided that the commissioner's determination of inequitability is reviewed for under an abuse of discretion standard rather than de novo.
But haven't we also said we review the tax commissioner's decision either for error of law, which would be de novo, or abuse of discretion? And so help me textually with why I'm less concerned with the constitutionality, but just the straight up textual application of the regulation and the inequitable piece of it. So there is double taxation that satisfies B4.1. So then we're left with, is it inequity attributable to Virginia rather than to the fact that some other state has a unique method of allocation and apportionment? Help me with that.
Sure. So, Justin McCullough, I think there is a textual ambiguity there, and I think there's two ways to resolve it, both of which come out in favor of the department.
Okay.
So, first of all, I think it's very important to realize that this regulation is not structured in terms of what is sufficient. It is structured in terms of what is necessary. The introductory language of the regulation says, the department will not grant permission to use an alternative unless these requirements are satisfied. Our friends on the other side seem to read that as saying the converse, which is, if the following are satisfied, the department will always grant permission. But that's not what the regulation says. The regulation says, we will not let you use an alternative unless you satisfy. So I think the court could say that's the threshold way of resolving it. I think the other challenge a little bit, and candidly, I think there is a certain amount of ambiguity in B2, because it says the inequity is attributable to Virginia, comma, rather than the fact that some other state uses a unique apportionment method. Now, as I understand the tenor of the discussion this morning, I think the challenge is this isn't exactly, we can't say that it's unique. 20-some states use some form of market-based sourcing. It's not unique. But I think it's also our position, for reasons that some of the members of the court have already identified, this is not properly understood as attributable to Virginia. The fact that other states have changed their own methods in an attempt to capture a larger portion of CEB sales does not make any overlap attributable to the Commonwealth, which hasn't changed its method in nearly six decades.
And let me ask you about that, though, because I would think, you know, we're talking about income tax, and if the income is clearly not generated within Virginia, and in the sense that the money comes from out of state, so as a sort of threshold common sense point, the income doesn't come from Virginia, but it is deemed to, by statute, arise from Virginia by operation of the statute. So why isn't it attributable to Virginia in that sort of common sense way?
Justice McCullough, I certainly see how you can view it that way, but I guess I would say that with respect, I don't think, your question began with where the income is coming from. And I think under both the Constitution and under the Code of Virginia, that's not the right question. Because the way the Code of Virginia works is we don't do it based on where the income comes from. We use it based on the cost of performance method. The Code says the way we determine where you tax intangibles is where the cost of performance is done, not where the income is from. So I don't think that's how the Code thinks about this at all. But I also don't think it's how the Constitution thinks about it, because this is the U.S. Supreme Court's language from Jefferson Lines. The Constitution, the bottom line constitutional question, is whether the value is, quote, fairly attributable to economic activity within the taxing state. The economic activity that generates these sales is happening in Virginia. The people who generate it are in Virginia. The intellectual property is created in Virginia. It is stored in Virginia. And because of the way that this particular system works, each and every time someone accesses CEB's servers, they are reaching out and making contact with a server that is in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we think the economic activity here is occurring in Virginia. So that makes this quite a straightforward case.
So isn't the word unique in this context meaning unique to us? Not unique to some, you know, polling of the 50 states, but unique to us. We've never done it this way. It's completely unique to us.
I think that's right, Justice Kelsey. And in speaking with the folks in the department, my understanding that the classic situation where that carve-out would apply. I was given an example of Ohio, which uses a completely different taxation method for a situation like this, for something called commercial activity. They have a commercial activity tax. They don't even have a corporate income tax. And so as a result, you can imagine that that produces a certain amount of overlap, because the way that Ohio and Virginia go about this is completely different. And in that situation, the department does not allow the taxpayer to use an alternative method, because they say that's not attributable to the fact that Virginia is doing something odd. That's attributable to the fact that Ohio has some unique method of apportioning that doesn't even involve corporate income tax.
So in other words, that is unique to us, what Ohio does.
And so from our perspective.
A destination-based model is also unique to us with intangibles.
I think the court could certainly read the regulation that way as well, and that would resolve any ambiguity that might otherwise exist in the regulation.
So you're reading unique as different as opposed to somehow outside the mainstream?
Well, Justice Powell, first and foremost, we don't think the court has to get to this, because we think that there's a threshold requirement, which is whether it is attributable to Virginia. And our fundamental submission is that it is not attributable to Virginia. So we don't think the court has to parse the precise meaning of the word unique. If the court were to, I think that is a reading that the court could adopt. But I don't think you need to, because I think there are at least two reasons you could rule for us before you ever got to that question in the first place.
Under your interpretation of attributable to Virginia, you turn back to the statute and say, well, the activity of producing these materials and the servers are located in Virginia. I mean, what are the scenarios under which it would ever be attributable to Virginia? Because it seems like if the statute says, we deem your activity to occur in Virginia, and then now it's attributable to Virginia, I'm just trying to figure out what meaning this regulation has at all.
Attributable to Virginia. So, Justice McCall, I think the example of that is, I've been made aware from the department, so it's cited on pages 64 and 65 of the joint appendix. We cite six examples where the department has previously allowed a taxpayer to use an alternative method. And one of those examples, I think the one that's most directly on point and helps illustrate the kind of thing the department is talking about, is a ruling. It's document number 94/268. And this is a situation where the department did allow a taxpayer to use an alternative method of apportionment. This basically involved a situation where the taxpayer's employees navigate ships through Virginia's waterways and those of other states. And the way the taxpayer billed its own customers, the way that they charge for their services, was on a mileage basis. That's how they decided what their customers would pay them. And it turned out that the boats, as I understand it, were berthed in Virginia. They started in Virginia. They left in Virginia. But the vast majority of the mileage wasn't actually done in Virginia. They started in Virginia. They went other places. They came back to Virginia. And the way they billed the customers was based on the miles. The vast majority of those miles didn't occur in Virginia. But nonetheless, under the default rules in Virginia, they would have been in a situation where they were paying Virginia tax on the overwhelming majority of that. And the department, in the exercise of its discretion, concluded that's not really attributable to the overlap. There was a lot of overlap. And they concluded that's attributable to Virginia because Virginia's taxation is not reflecting how their business actually works. And we think that's the kind of situation that in the exercise of the department, they could conclude. I guess another way to think about how we think about inequity more generally.
If they had a regional office in Ohio and some folks there that developed a specific product, but it's the Virginia-based company, so then, to use the analogy you just employed, that conceivably the department could segment off the Ohio product and income and not.
I think conceivably, yes. And I think that helps illustrate what we think the inequitable provision and the regulation that implemented is done. We think that's designed as a safety valve. We completely agree with that characterization. And it's designed for a situation where there is a glitch, where there is a malfunction, where there is an unanticipated consequence, where the normally applicable rules combine because of somehow the way they interface or with the way the taxpayer does its business to produce a result that is not anticipated, that is not does not make sense under the basic apportionment formula. I think it is absolutely critical here to recognize that is not what CEB is arguing. CEB is not arguing that the cost of performance mechanism set forth in the statute is glitching or malfunctioning. CEB is objecting to the basic theory underlying the statute. This is not the unanticipated case. This is a classic case involving the sales of intangible goods. And CEB in their reply brief really does not in any way challenge our claim that this argument is not unique to them. If CEB can make this argument any number of other Virginia taxpayers could make presumably the precise same argument. And we think that's highly significant because it's not the unanticipated case, it's not a glitch, it's not a malfunction. And given that, and especially given the fact that the General Assembly has in recent years specifically declined to adopt proposals to do the very method that CEB asked the department to adopt here, means that the department did not exceed its discretion in declining their request. Unless the court has further questions, I cede the remainder of my time.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The department seems to be arguing that its regulation is ambiguous. We don't think it's ambiguous. We think unique means aberrant, one of a kind, not usual. And I think we clearly meet that standard.
But does unique mean other states are just making a tax grab, that the default is changing because of the nature of this particular industry?
Well,
it's not unique. That's just the ground beneath us is moving. Unique is, as he was describing to me, sounds fact-specific, sounds unforeseeable, sounds unanticipated. You're building a lot on one word, not of the statute, but of the regulation.
Well, Your Honor, I think unique means those things. I think but the regulation really is designed to say, if you have double taxation, and you can show it's not some unusual, aberrant thing that another state is doing, the department's going to give you relief. The department has to give you relief.
So when does it become not aberrant? 10 states, 12 states, 13 states, 40 states? I mean, when does Virginia lose its capacity for source taxation by tying our own hands?
If I can answer, yes. I don't know the dividing line, the exact dividing line, but I think we're way beyond that in this case. I think we're in a situation where we know 23 states are taking some of CEB's sales. We know that only one-third approximately of the states during the years in question had a sourcing method similar to Virginia's for intangibles. So we know that what these other states are doing is not unique in any possible concept of what unique means.
Your time has expired. Call the next case.